You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And a tip of the hat, many thanks to Dr. Mike for filling in for me yesterday. It's my next book was due, and it was the insane deadline day. And I hate taking the day off the radio. I just absolutely, you know, I love doing this show, but it's like I just had to read it one last time before we sent it off to the publisher. And but I've been working on this thing on weekends for almost 2 years, year and a half now. So it's going to be a good book. Anyhow, in our second hour today, Dr. Ravi Batra is going to drop by for much of the hour, and we're going to talk about economics, one of our favorite economists. And in our third hour, Tim Carpenter, National Director of the Progressive Democrats of America, is going to be in the studio, and you'll get a fill-in on what's up with pdamerica.org. And some interesting things going on here in Washington, D.C., and all around the country. But today, March 19th, is the anniversary. It was tonight. It was arguably March 20th on the calendar in Iraq, but it was the night of March 19th that, for us here in the United States, that the bombing commenced in Baghdad, that George W. Bush opened the gates of hell, that led to the death of somewhere between 150,000 and 600,000 Iraqis, over 4,000 American soldiers, the displacement of at least 5 million Iraqis, an orgy of death squad and sectarian violence that continues to this day. I mean, here's the really poignant story. This from today's New York Times. Today's New York Times. Be a second paragraph by article by Tim Arango. Beginning in the early morning Tuesday with the assassination of the Ministry of Finance official by a bomb attached to his vehicle and continuing for hours, the attacks. Actually, let me read the first sentence. Here's the first two sentences of the article. Iraq closed a painful decade just as it began with explosions reverberating around the capital. Beginning in the early morning Tuesday with the assassination of a Ministry of Finance official by a bomb attached to his vehicle and continuing for hours, the attacks were a devastating reminder of the violence that regularly afflicts Iraq. And they seem somehow more poignant coming on the eve of the 10th anniversary of the American-led invasion, which has been marked in the West by new books, academic studies, and polls, retesting public attitudes a decade later. And then they talk about the familiar sight of black smoke over the cityscape. This is amazing. I mean, now is the time when Vince Bugliosi, and you know, in fact, I had suggested to Louise and Sean that we should get him on the show today. Apparently, he was not available. But Vince Bugliosi wrote this. His name is spelled like it was pronounced Bugliosi, but he drops the G. The guy who wrote Helter Skelter, who prosecuted Charles Manson, he wrote a book, and it was a prosecutor's brief. I mean, he's a prosecuting attorney. It's a prosecutor's brief for the attorney general of any state in the union to prosecute George W. Bush for murder. In fact, the title of the book is The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, by Vincent Bugliosi. This book came out in 2008, and it's every bit as relevant today as it was then. At that point in time, it was obvious to all of us that we had been lied into an unnecessary war that was leading to hundreds of thousands of deaths, the devastation of a nation, the devastation of a culture. And just in terms of our geopolitical interests, if you buy the notion that a Shiite Iran needs to have something strong on its border to restrain it from an expansionist tendency towards all the Sunni countries around it, then a Sunni-controlled Saddam Hussein-run government in Baghdad, in Iraq, was actually our barrier. I mean, this is why, for a decade, back before W became president, in fact, back before his daddy became president, why Americans, you know, supported both sides. Actually, we supported both sides, both Iran and Iraq. It's kind of a pox on both their houses. But we particularly supported Saddam Hussein in his war with Iran. Over a million Iraqis and over a million Iranians died in that war. It was a horrible and bloody front. But we supported him in that. Don Rumsfeld went over during, the first Bush administration? No, it must have been the Nixon administration. It would have to be. Or maybe the Jerry Ford administration. Don Rumsfeld went over and sold him weapons of mass destruction. There's a famous picture of Don Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein. So what was the first big business to open in Iraq after the war was, quote, over? This is just last year and a half ago or so. It was the Bank of Iran, the Bank of Tehran, Iran. Iraq is now, you know, the majority of people in Iraq are actually Shiites, and Iraq is now largely controlled by Shiites, and it's aligned itself more closely with Iran than with us. Now, I'm not complaining about that. I mean, I think Iraq should have the right to determine their own fate and future. But, you know, if George W. Bush was trying to justify this in a geopolitical context, it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. The only way that the war against Iraq makes any sense, and this is what Cindy Sheehan laid out in front of John Conyers' commission when she testified before Congress, is that George W. Bush thought that being a wartime president would get him political capital that he could use when he was reelected in 2005, and sure enough, he tried to privatize Social Security. And back in 1999, a year before he even was running for president, his family hired Mickey Herskowitz to write his biography, The Charge to Keep, and Mickey wrote the first draft, and then they found somebody else to write the second draft because Mickey didn't suck up enough. But he had, you know, almost 100 hours of audio tape recordings with George W. And he was interviewed by Robert Perry, and this is on the record with a journalist, Mickey Herskowitz. Well, I'll let Cindy Sheehan share with you the actual quote.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
There you go. This is George W. Bush saying, you know, I'm going to become a, you know, a wartime president. So James Madison wrote about this, how war gives the executive branch additional powers, and therefore it can be an incredibly corrupting influence. And beware of presidents who want to use war. This is the argument that the Republicans were making in the 1930s, saying, oh, Franklin Roosevelt wants to use war with Germany or Japan to claim even more power than he's already taken with the New Deal. We can't let him do that. It's why Roosevelt, you know, ran when he ran for re-election in 1940 on the platform of I will not get us into World War II. Because the Republicans, had he not, I mean, you know, the Republicans, they were freaking out. We don't want to get into this war. Hitler's just fine. Thank you very much. Sort of. 15 minutes past the hour. What do we do? How do we prosecute George W. Bush?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And all of his cronies, these mass murderers from the Bush administration. Why is there no accountability? And one of our callers today is going to receive a free signed copy of my book, Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country. So Vince Bugliosi suggests that while the federal laws against murder are fairly thin, in fact, when Jack Kennedy was assassinated, there was no federal law against murder. There were only state laws, which is why the state of Texas, the attorney general of the state of Texas, loudly and strongly objected to the federal government taking the body of Jack Kennedy out of Texas and, you know, taking the jurisdiction away. Of course, that was presumably solved by the assassination of Lee Harvey Oswald by Jack Ruby. But nonetheless, the federal laws against murder are fairly thin. Now, there is again, now it is against the law to assassinate certain kinds of federal officials and things like that, but basically it's the state prosecutors who have the murder laws. And so Bugliosi's hypothesis is that any state secretary of state has the authority to prosecute George W. Bush or other members of the Bush administration for murder. And he builds this prosecutor's brief in his book for this so-called war in Iraq. I remember, I mean, this it's 10 years ago today. I remember maybe 11 years ago, 10 and a half years ago, I was out in Seattle with Paul Loeb, and we were at a church there, and Scott Ritter was speaking. And there were so many people waiting to get into that church to hear Scott Ritter speak that we stood in that line that went around the block for like an hour to get in. And we were way up in the second floor in the pews, way up where the, I don't know, the choir's up there or something. And it was, and you know, and I was traveling around the country. Mark Crispin Miller and I did presentations in New York City. This was before we'd started our radio show. I was traveling around the country giving speeches with people like Paul Loeb and Mark Crispin Miller and others saying, don't go to war. We could all see the handwriting on the wall. You know, George W. Bush had been this drumbeat to invade Iraq ever since 9/11. All these conflations of Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden, although bin Laden and Saddam Hussein hated each other. And Osama bin Laden, you know, after the Afghan war was successful, he went back home to Saudi Arabia and he raised a little army and took them to the border of Saudi Arabia and Iraq and was going to invade Iraq. And the royal family arrested him and deported him to Yemen or Somalia, one or the other, wherever his mother was from, and stripped him of his Saudi citizenship because he wanted to go after Saddam Hussein. Why did he want to? Why did Osama bin Laden declare war on Saddam Hussein? Because Saddam Hussein was secular. He was a Sunni Muslim, just like bin Laden was. But Saddam Hussein let women go to college. He let women be doctors, let women be teachers, let women be lawyers, let women wear pants, let women drive cars. And this so offended Osama bin Laden that he literally tried to invade Iraq. He tried to invade Iraq. A decade before George W. Bush tried to invade Iraq, or did invade Iraq. And yet, you had these useful idiots in the media, the Judy Millers and the whole bunch of them. Going, well, maybe, 9-11, Saddam Hussein, 9-11, Saddam Hussein. There was nothing. Iraq and Saddam Hussein had absolutely nothing to do with 9-11. In fact, the opposite. If Saddam Hussein had been able to kill Osama bin Laden, he would have done it in a heartbeat. And there would have been nobody to fund 9-11. So why did we invade Iraq? Well, you just heard George W. Bush basically laying it out. And well, clip number one, Shane, here he is making the case. I mean, when we were hearing this kind of rhetoric, this is the kind of stuff that got Paul and Mark and I out in the streets and you know, organizing groups all over the country, showing up all over the country at I mean, there were more people in the streets worldwide protesting the run-up to the war in Iraq than ever in the history of the world there had been people in the streets. Millions of people. Here's George W. Bush.
The evidence indicates that Iraq is reconstituting its nuclear weapons program.
No.
Saddam Hussein has held numerous meetings with Iraqi nuclear scientists.
No.
A group he calls his nuclear mujahideen.
No.
His nuclear holy warriors.
No.
Facing clear evidence of peril. We cannot wait for the final proof. The smoking gun. That could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Right. A mushroom cloud. And then, of course, Condoleezza Rice repeated that line on national television on Meet the Press. We can't wait for the, you know, for the final proof to be the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. It was a great line. Very well written. I don't know who the speechwriter was who wrote it. Maybe it was David Frum, maybe it was somebody else, but, you know, whoever it was, I mean, it was like, I think it's a matter of historical record who it was, and there was a time when I knew, but it's, the point is that it was all lies. Here's Cheney, lying. And he knew he was lying. Clip two.
Simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt that he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us.
And clip number five, here's Rumsfeld lying about it.
The area in the south and the west and the north that coalition forces control is substantial. It happens not to be the area where weapons of mass destruction were dispersed. We know where they are. They're in the area around Tikrit and Baghdad and east, west, south, and north somewhat.
Right, and clip six, here he is connecting Iraq to al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda continues to have a deep interest in acquiring weapons of mass destruction. As with the story of Zakawi and his network, I can trace the story of a senior terrorist operative telling how Iraq provided training in these weapons to al-Qaeda.
And that's Colin Powell. I mean, tragically, and he had real doubts about that. We'll be right back, 27 minutes.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So when are we going to hit some kind of a critical mass where we say, you know, our veterans have had enough, our country has had enough, the Iraqis have had enough, it's time to put some people on trial? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And this is incredible. Thomas Young writes an open letter to George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. He says, I write this letter on the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War on behalf of my fellow Iraq War veterans. I write this letter on behalf of the 4,488 soldiers and Marines who died in Iraq. I write this letter on behalf of the hundreds of thousands of veterans who have been wounded and on behalf of those whose wounds, physical and psychological, have destroyed their lives. I am one of those gravely wounded, he writes. I was paralyzed in an insurgent ambush in 2004 in Sadr City. My life is coming to an end. I am living under hospice care. I write this letter on behalf of the husbands and wives who have lost spouses, on behalf of children who have lost a parent, on behalf of the fathers and mothers who have lost sons and daughters, and on behalf of those who care for the many thousands of my fellow veterans who have brain injuries. I write this letter on behalf of those veterans whose trauma and self-revulsion for what they have witnessed, endured, and done in Iraq has led to suicide, and on behalf of the active duty soldiers and Marines who commit, on average, a suicide a day. I write this letter on behalf of some 1 million Iraqi dead and on behalf of the countless Iraqi wounded. You may evade, and then he speaks directly to Dick Cheney and George W. Bush, you may evade justice, but in our eyes you are each guilty of egregious war crimes, of plunder, and finally of murder, including the murder of thousands of young Americans, my fellow veterans whose future you stole. I write this letter, my last letter. This is a dying veteran writing this. I write this letter, my last letter, to you, Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney. I write not because I think you grasp the terrible human and moral consequences of your lies, manipulation, and thirst for wealth and power. I write this letter because before my own death, I want to make it clear that I and hundreds of thousands of my fellow veterans, along with millions of my fellow citizens, along with hundreds of millions more in Iraq and the Middle East, know fully who you are and what you have done. You may evade justice, but in our eyes you are guilty of egregious war crimes, of plunder, and finally of murder, including the murder of thousands of young Americans, my fellow Americans, whose future you stole. This is a letter to George W. Bush and Dick Cheney from Tomas Young, an Iraq war veteran who is right now dying. He's in hospice care. He says to Bush and Cheney, your positions of authority, your millions of dollars of personal wealth, your public relation consultants, your privilege and your power cannot mask the hollowness of your character. You set us to fight and die in Iraq after you, Mr. Cheney, dodged the draft in Vietnam, and you, Mr. Bush, went AWOL from your National Guard unit. Your cowardice and selfishness were established decades ago. You were not willing to risk yourselves for your nation, but you sent hundreds of thousands of young men and women to be sacrificed in a senseless war with no more thought than it takes to put out the garbage. And from there he goes on. He joined the Army because of 9/11, and on every level, he says, moral, strategic, military, and economic, Iraq was a failure, and it was you, Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney, who started this war. It is you who should pay the consequences. I would not have to lie in my bed, my body filled with painkillers, my life ebbing away, and deal with the fact that hundreds of thousands of human beings, including children, including myself, were sacrificed by you for little more than the greed of oil companies, for your alliance with the oil sheikhs of Saudi Arabia, and your insane vision of empires. We were used, we were betrayed, and we have been abandoned. You, Mr. Bush, make much pretense of being a Christian, but isn't lying a sin? Isn't murder a sin? Aren't theft and selfish ambitions sins? He ends his letter saying, my day of reckoning is upon me. Yours will come. I hope you will be put on trial. But mostly I hope for your sakes that you find the moral courage to face what you have done to me and to the many, many others who deserved to live. I hope that before your time on earth ends, as mine is now ending, you will find the strength of character to stand before the American public and the world, and in particular the Iraqi people, and beg for forgiveness. The letter was published over truthdig.org. It's reprinted over Democratic Underground and a number of other places. Raed Girar, an Arab-American blogger and architect, writing for the Progressive Media Project. I was born in Iraq, and in 2003 I was in Baghdad. As we feared, President George W. Bush launched his war of choice on March 20th. We survived, but we were among the lucky ones. He talks about 4,500 young American men and women were killed. U.S. taxpayers will end up with a $3 trillion bill. The Iraq fiasco also damaged America's credibility and reputation around the world. I mean, here's Helen Thomas. Remember the first, we were sold a series of rationales. Oh, well, you know, Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. No, it turns out he had nothing to do with 9/11. But they tried to pitch that. You heard that clip from Colin Powell before. Then, oh, yeah, it's WMD. We know that there's weapons of mass destruction. That was the one that seemed to work the best because the weapons inspectors had been pulled out. And here, Helen Thomas, this is very short. She says, she's asking Ari Fleischer, another guy who should be in the dock in The Hague. Helen Thomas asking Ari Fleischer about those WMDs.
But it wouldn't be disappointing, would it, if there were no weapons there?
We know for a fact that there are weapons there.
Right. Right. And as you heard Rumsfeld, well, here it's worth hearing again, clip number 5. This is Rumsfeld telling us where the weapons are as we're in the process of, you know, overrunning the country.
Area in the south and the west and the north that coalition forces control is substantial. It happens not to be the area where weapons of mass destruction were dispersed. We know where they are. They're in the area around Tikrit and Baghdad and east, west, south, and north somewhat.
Yeah, there you go. And now Rumsfeld's got a book out. Isn't that cute? And probably got $1 million advance for it. I mean, it's just, this is like, it's just bizarre. It is just bizarre. Gene in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Gene, thanks for listening to AM950. What's up?
Hi. I'm glad you're keeping on this subject. Every time I hear you know, it being talked about, all I can think of is 10 years ago when we heard people asking Rumsfeld how long the war would take, and his answer was flipping, you know, 3 months, maybe 6 months top. And all we could do, my wife and I, is look at each other and just say, how can anyone believe that? And you know, in this day and age of guerrilla warfare, and it kind of related to when they went into Baghdad and, you know, they thought that was a big deal. Well, it was just the beginning, knowing that, you know, they aren't wearing uniforms and standing out there and surrendering. They're going to be there sniping at us for the next 10 years.
Yeah. Nobody likes to have their country occupied. This was an this was an invasion and an occupation, far more than a war. I mean, they never declared a war on us.
The 6 month claim was just, you know, that was about as irresponsible and as much of a lie as anything else.
Yeah, and you had the you had other neocons say, oh, you know, it's going to cost $1 billion or $2 billion. You know, the oil money will pay for it. It's not going to cost us anything. It's cost us $3 trillion, and it may cost us as much as $6 trillion. You know, just imagine with that, we could send an entire generation of young people to college. With that, we could build hospitals and provide health care all across the United States. I mean, $3 trillion is a mind-boggling amount of money. Gene, thank you so much for the call. Nate in Annapolis, Maryland. Hey, Nate, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I'm doing all right. Hey, as a veteran who participated in the invasion of Iraq, I have to agree with you. And as a conservative, that doesn't happen very often. But I think that the war in Iraq was a complete disaster. All that aside, it seems like you're kind of hinting at it, but I'm curious, you know, I think that the president and the National Command Authority saw the opportunity to install a friendly democracy in a very oil-rich country. And I was curious as to your thoughts about, you know, do you think that that was the motivation behind the invasion?
Well, Dick Cheney was given two jobs in January of 2001 when he became vice president. One was to head up the counterterrorism task force, which never even got around to meeting until the first week of September, a week before 9/11. And the second was the energy task force, which was getting together with the oil companies and carving up Iraq's oil fields in March of 2001, 6 months before 9/11. They were carving up Iraq's oil fields, and these documents are now public. You know, they've been exposed publicly. Here's what Cheney had to say at that time.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserves, second only to Saudi Arabia.
And he literally was heading up the secret commission in the White House that was deciding which countries and which companies were going to get which oil fields, the undeveloped and the developed oil fields in Iraq. So, yeah, Nate, I think that oil had a lot to do with it. Thanks a lot for the call. 45 minutes past the hour. What do we do with war criminals in our midst? Do we just shun them? I mean, that's largely what's been happening. Or do you prosecute them?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Is this so big that we can't do it ourselves as a nation? Should we turn it over to The Hague? Should we ask the Spanish to do it, the Germans? Welcome back, 10 minutes before the hour. 1994, this would have been during the... Yeah, this is the Clinton administration. This was just after the Bush administration. And somebody asked Dick Cheney, a news reporter asked Dick Cheney, when you were in the George W. Bush administration, why didn't you go all the way to Baghdad after you kicked Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait? And here's what Dick Cheney had to say.
Do you think that the U.S. or U.N. forces should have moved into Baghdad?
No.
Why not?
Because if we'd gone to Baghdad, we would have been all alone. There wouldn't have been anybody else with us. It would have been a U.S. occupation of Iraq. None of the Arab forces that were willing to fight with us in Kuwait were willing to invade Iraq. Once you got to Iraq and took it over and took down Saddam Hussein's government, then what are you going to put in its place? That's a very volatile part of the world, and if you take down the central government in Iraq, you can easily end up seeing pieces of Iraq fly off, part of it the Syrians would like to have to the west, part of eastern Iraq, the Iranians would like to claim, fought over for 8 years. In the north, you've got the Kurds, and if the Kurds spin loose and join with the Kurds in Turkey, then you threaten the territorial integrity of Turkey. It's a quagmire if you go that far and try to take over Iraq.
It's Dick Cheney in 1994. These guys knew what they were doing. They knew what they were doing. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Tom. Are you there?
Yeah, I am. You're on the air.
Okay. Hey, I was really touched by the letter that you read earlier, written by the veteran.
Yeah, by Tomas, let's name him. Tomas Young is who wrote
yes,
that.
Yes, that's very touching, and for him to, I think he was speaking out of the light, the courageous light within himself. My goodness, that is really something. I appreciate you reading that. And I just want to say to him and any of the other veterans that are listening that there's a lot of us out here in this country who are with you. We're going to be here. We're all dying. People don't realize we're all dying, but that doesn't make it right to kill. And we're all going to be here trying to sustain life on Earth as long as we can. And we just hope that we can come together around that, greening up the Earth.
There you go. Bob, thank you for the call, and thanks for your words. John in Mahopac, New York. Am I saying it right, John?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. You're on the air.
I just wanted to comment. You were talking about trying President Bush at The Hague, and I completely agree with that. I don't see why the United States should be exempt. I mean, in a global age like today, you know, we're the first ones always to call out these world leaders for war crimes, and I don't see why President Bush should be any different.
Are you a veteran?
Yes, I am.
And you still think that good? I'm curious. Did you serve in any of the?
I served in the surge in 07.
Uh-huh.
And also, I was one of the last units to leave to clean up the mess, so to speak. And
wow.
There was no reason for us to be there. It was just, you know, it was a useless war, in my opinion. So I think he's fully. He should be tried for war crimes.
Do most of your colleagues think the same way, John?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Do you think that most of your colleagues, the vets who were there toward the end in Iraq, that they got it, how useless and tragic this war was?
I think I'm more of an exception. I think many of my colleagues, at least the ones that I worked with, didn't really... If they had a thought on the war at all, you know, it would have been that it was worth it.
Right. It's got to be a really hard thing to deal with, you know, to think that what one has done or what one has committed oneself to, particularly, you know, if it involves things like killing other people, was unnecessary. That's got to be such a mentally difficult place to go that it's got to be really, really hard for veterans to... In my opinion,
it's terrible. I, you know, the thought that you were slaughtering these people at the same time they're firing at you, you have to fire back. But
yeah,
I mean, the major question is why, and there's no answer to that. Why did we do it? I don't see an answer. So.
Yeah.
But thank you for your time, Paul.
Thank you, John. Thank you for your service and for your call.
Thank you.
Tim in Dos Rios, California. Hey, Tim.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I wanted to address your about the trying them for war crimes as well. I think it's a great idea, though I wouldn't see why it would change anything if they're linked up with the corporations, and I would tend to doubt that they would allow that to happen. That would be a great spectacle.
I think if it were to happen, it would dissuade future presidents from going down those roads.
That would be really interesting to see what would happen.
You know, I think after the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, there should have been a war crimes trial for Lyndon Johnson.
Exactly. And there were protests going on back then, and it didn't happen. Though right now it's perhaps different in America, but what I look at is what we can do to change from a more core place. I see that we're pretty much bound to be... In our economic lives, we pay for being alive. You know, we have to go to work and make money to pay for our bodily functions. The water is polluted. We have to pay for water. We have to pay for food. We have to pay for a place to sleep and use a toilet. And it's illegal almost to not do some of those things. And I don't, to me, I see that as one form of activism. And I also respect all the other activists that are literally out on the streets and whatnot.
Yeah. Okay. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. David in Pacific, Washington, listening on KBCS. David, we just have a minute to the end of the hour.
Thank you, Tom. I finally have a thing to disagree with you. You were talking earlier about the politicians and they sell these weaponry to the Saudis or whatever, who's ever in control. But I beg to differ. They give these as gifts to these people. I worked on a PCG 615 in the 80s that was headed from Tacoma to Norfolk, Virginia as a gift to the Saudis. And I know for a fact they don't transfer money. It's just a pat on the back, and it's for favors.
So this is our foreign aid, is here, have some weapons.
Exactly.
Or here, have some money to buy some weapons. It helps out the war profiteers who have these multi-million-dollar mansions ringing the city here in Washington, D.C. Makes perfect sense. David, thank you for calling. Thanks for listening to KBCS. We'll be back. We're going to get into economics. Might there be a crash coming? Ravi Batra will tell us all about it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour, the second hour of our program. For the next 45 minutes, Dr. Ravi Batra is going to be with us. He is professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, the international best-selling author of numerous books, including The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos, and The New Golden Age. No, that's not right. And for some reason, Ravi, Dr. Batra, I have your book here written down twice. What's the title? I'm sorry, the title of your other book?
Greenspan's Fraud, remember that?
Oh, Greenspan's Fraud. Thank you so much. Yes. Well, actually, one of my very favorite books. It's just been a while since I said it out loud, and I don't know. I guess we're all getting older here. Anyhow, Greenspan's Fraud, and great to have you back with us, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
So, Cyprus, this is the front page story in the New York Times. I just printed it. I was going to share a piece. Well, actually, I can read it from the screen. The Cypriot Parliament on Tuesday overwhelmingly repudiated a $10 billion international bailout package that would have set an extraordinary precedent by taxing ordinary depositors to pay part of the bill. Basically, if I have this right, the European Union was saying to Cyprus, you owe us $10 billion. We're going to loan you $10 billion to stay liquid, to stay, you know, so that, you know, basically because unemployment's so high, so that you can pay your unemployment costs and healthcare costs and whatnot for people who are no longer working. And because the banksters crashed the economy, we're going to loan you that money, but you need to pay it back to us by taking money out of everybody's checking account. The Cypriots said, no, we're not going to do that. We can get into where that's going to go, but I'm curious your thoughts on what would have happened if they had said yes and said, okay, everybody's going to have, they're going to lose 6 or 8 or 9% of the money in their checking account and savings account.
If they had said yes, then that would set a very bad precedent for banking in Europe. You know, it's not just Cyprus. Then you have Greece, Italy, Portugal, Spain. Banks are in trouble, you know, in all these countries, and then the depositors wouldn't be sure about their deposits anymore. So if they had said yes, it would have been very bad for the entire euro. And I think it's a wise move on their part to reject it, but the question now is what's next? And those people who proposed this mayor, they either have to eat crow or keep pushing for it, and that means the crisis will go on for perhaps another week.
Yeah. Had the Cypriots done this, would that not have led to a run on the banks in Cyprus?
Well, they would have a bank holiday,
right?
And so they would not allow the any withdrawals from the bank for a little while.
Right.
But it would set a bad precedent for the entire Eurozone, because the banks are stretched out in almost in UK, in France, not in Germany, but almost everywhere else, the banks are have a lot of problems.
Right. So you could see other countries doing this, and at that point, the people of Europe are going to start saying, we can't trust our own banks, and then you're going to see something that's going to look like 1930, late 32, early 33 here in the United States, isn't it? Wouldn't you?
That's right, and that's the thing that this would have been this would have set a precedent for that, and there would have been bank runs on banks, and so who knows where it would have gone. But the crisis is still not over, because the problem is that Cyprus is a special situation. It gets a lot of, the banks there get a lot of money from Russian depositors. And there's a lot of money laundering there, so the Germans have to pay the money eventually for the bailout.
Right.
So they were saying, why should we protect the Russians? So it's a lot more complicated than just a run on the bank.
Cyprus is for the Russians what the Bahamas or the Cayman Islands are for American. Russian billionaires are using Cyprus as a way to stash their money and avoid paying taxes on it, the same way that American billionaires are using the Cayman Islands to stash their money and avoid paying taxes on it. Do I have that right?
That's right. And that's why the Germans are so reluctant to bail out Cyprus without extracting some kind of cost from that country, because the Russians are involved. And then the elections are coming up in Germany, I think, in September. So there are a lot of other factors also involved in the whole scenario.
Wow, we're back to Hitler and Stalin. I mean, we're back to Russia and Germany, you know, at loggerheads. And in fact, I mean, this parallel is a little spooky, but today this is the front page story in the New York Times. You know, the headline, Cyprus rejects bank deposit tax, scuttling bailout deal. And let me just read two sentences from this. They're talking about the crowds out in front of the Cypriot parliament, you know, when they turned this thing down. Some wielded unflattering, and they're talking about the protesters, some wielded unflattering posters of Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany a day after a demonstrator breached security at the German embassy and climbed to the roof, throwing down the German flag. Quote, a pensioner, Dimitris, 67, who would only give his first name, said, quote, today Germany is engaging in Nazism again, not with the weapon of force, but with money, end quote. This is we had a fellow from Greece on our TV show back, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago, who was talking about how basically with the euro, what's happened is that the euro is the old Deutschmark, that the Germans have won World War II. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's the whole problem, that all over the world there are economic troubles. Wages are stagnant while productivity keeps rising, so you have excess production everywhere. Goods are not selling. So the rich are getting richer because of all these, because of the current economic system. So the very rich countries like Germany have to bail out those that can't afford the current system the way it is. And bailing out is not that. I mean, the Germans have to be, they have been bailing out these countries for a long time now. So they have, and their patience is running out. They're running thin. Patience is running thin. So the problem is with the fundamental economic system, and until they reform the system, this will keep on going.
Mm-hmm.
And so far they have been stabilized. They have stabilized the system by using all these gimmicks, so much budget deficit, so much printing of money, not just in Europe, but also in the United States, and in fact, all over the world. But this can't keep on going forever. And slowly and slowly, we are approaching the day when our system is going to collapse. And I have put a date on it. I have said it should be around 2016, or by that time, the system would collapse. Because
internationally,
Internationally, right. There are cracks everywhere in the world, and they are patching up these cracks through borrowed money. And how long can debt go on? It's not possible to go on forever.
Yeah, yeah. Is the United States relatively immune from this because we control our own currency?
Yes, the U.S. It being the key currency area can borrow almost unlimited amounts from China, Japan, and even the Federal Reserve. But even there is reward against huge budget deficits. The budget deficit is coming down. In an economy where wages are stagnant and productivity keeps rising sharply, whenever the budget deficit starts to fall, it takes about 6 to 8 months before trouble strikes. The budget deficits began to fall in Europe about a year ago, and now they're back to recession and things are getting worse.
So when our budget deficits fall, we're going to have a problem. Let's continue this after the break. We're talking with Dr. Ravi Batra. His website, ravibatra.com, RAVIBATRA.com, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, author of the international best-selling books, The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Ravi Batra, RAVIBATRA.com. We'll be right back. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dr. Ravi Batra, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, the international best-selling author of The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos, the guy who saw all this coming, the guy who saw the last crash coming, and who laid out, you know, Greenspan's Fraud, his other book, another one of his many books. You can read them all at ravibatra.com. Dr. Batra, you said that Europe's budget deficit went down, and what followed was unemployment and recession. Everybody, all the politicians in the United States are talking about decreasing our budget deficit. Why would decreasing a budget deficit cause there to be unemployment and recession?
Well, there is not enough consumer demand in the economy because wages are stagnant. People's salaries have been falling for a very long time, so there's not enough consumer demand. And when supply exceeds demand, when there is too much supply of goods and not enough consumer demand, that's when people are laid off. Mm-hmm. So to make up for that demand shortfall, the government has been spending a lot of money through its extra budget deficit. The budget deficit has been over $1 trillion for the past 3-4 years, and that has stabilized our economy. But once the budget deficit starts to fall, with wages stagnant, then consumer demand, then total demand goes down, and so supply is greater than demand even more, and therefore there are layoffs.
And this becomes a vicious cycle.
Yeah, it's a vicious cycle. We've seen that occurring in Europe. Well, we should not have an economy that depends so much on the government spending, on government deficit. We should have a good economy, which we used to have until about 1980. Now, we did not need much in the form of budget deficit until 1980, and we had unemployment rates around 3%, 4%, 5%, with the exception of the 1970s because of the huge jump in the price of oil. We had high unemployment rates, but otherwise, our unemployment was around 4% and 5%, and we did not need huge budget deficits to keep employment high. But ever since they introduced the supply side economics or Reaganomics, that was in 1981, and then again through what George Bush did in 2001. So ever since they introduced these new economic ideas, we have needed huge budget deficits to keep the economy growing and keep people employed.
Now, Elizabeth Warren pointed out yesterday that traditionally from, I guess, the George Washington administration till Reagan, that as productivity went up, wages pretty much followed that line. And in other words, wages went up along with productivity. But starting with the Reagan administration, productivity continued to rise, wages flattened out. She believed that if wages had kept up with productivity, right now the minimum wage would be around $22 an hour. The fellow that she was interviewing, an economist who was speaking before Congress, said no, it would actually be around $33 an hour. And so is it that simple, really, that wages haven't kept up with productivity? The top 1% has taken that gap. They've taken all that money in the middle and left working class people with so little money that they can't produce demand adequate to drive the economy?
That's right. This is the theory of the wage productivity gap. I guess they finally read my books about I've been talking about this theory ever since 1999.
Yes.
Remember that year. That was the year we had a budget surplus. And see the impact of this government deficit? In 1999, we had a rare budget surplus, and the stock market crashed in the year 2000.
Right.
So the moment in an economy where productivity rises fast, but wages don't, unless the government's deficit keeps rising, you have a crash.
So you basically, what you're saying as an economist, as a professor of economics, is that politically we have a choice. We can either finance demand, because you've got to have demand to drive an economy. We can either finance demand by having the government borrow money and spend it, and, you know, however it spends it, it eventually ends up in people's pockets, and they use that to buy things, creating demand. Or you can make sure that wages keep up with productivity. You can raise wages, but, you know, you have to do one or the other.
That's right. So there are two types of policies. Some policies allow wages to keep up with productivity. Other policies don't, and when wages don't keep up with productivity, then you have to keep raising the budget deficit to stabilize employment.
So when we look in the 1980s, there's a couple of things that I see it seems like maybe that was the point at which wages flattened out. We see the destruction of labor unions. We see the elimination of high marginal tax rates on millionaires and billionaires. And we see a change in the rules for compensation so that people can be compensated with stock and pay a maximum 15% capital gains tax rather than regular compensation and pay these high tax rates. Are those the things that caused this separation, that caused the billionaires to make off with everything, or am I missing something?
Those are some of the things, but the most important things are that the minimum wage did not rise at all under Reagan. And that did not, and the people's wages are linked to the minimum wage. The minimum wage serves as the base, and then you add skill premium to the minimum wage to get to a skill-based wage. Hmm. So the minimum wage did not rise under Reagan at all. And then you had additionally free trade, outsourcing, huge trade deficit, all of these things allowed companies to move factories abroad, manufacturing went down, labor demand did not rise as a result, so wages could not rise, would not rise, even though productivity kept rising. And the irony is that free trade and outsourcing, they raise productivity, but at the same time, they make wages go down, so it's a double whammy, double jeopardy. On the economy.
Right. So the billionaires make out even more, the economic realists, they get even more money. The average working person gets even less, and demand falls in the economy, and government has to step in, and if it doesn't, we're all screwed. We'll be back. Dr. Batra, you can stick around for our next segment?
Sure. Yeah, sure.
That would be great. We'll be back with Dr. Avi Batra.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
If you have not read his books, The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud, do so. Get over to RaviBatra.com and check it out. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dr. Ravi Batra on the line with us, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, international best-selling author of numerous books, including two of my favorites, Greenspan's Fraud and The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos. You can find all about all of it at his website, Ravi Batra, RaviBatra.com. Dr. Batra, we're talking about how this, starting with this, maybe the lit fuse of Cyprus, how this may play out. Spain now has 25-30% unemployment. Greece has very, very high unemployment. the Germans and the wealthier European states are perceived increasingly as plunderers across Europe. And yet, in here in the United States, because of Reaganomics and these insane free trade policies, our own middle class has been wiped out. Is this the disaster capitalism that Naomi Klein talked about? Is this creating a disaster and then profiting off of it? Or is this just the consequence of misguided ideology, almost a theology, the Milton Friedman theology?
Well, I have another theory called the law of social cycle. And I wrote that about that law in 1978, predicting the downfall of both Soviet communism and monopoly capitalism. And I wrote in that book that Soviet communism would collapse by the year 2000, and then monopoly capitalism would get into big trouble around 2010. And then I updated all that stuff in the books that you talked about, and in the update I wrote that by 2016, we should see a collapse of monopoly capitalism all over the world. So that's what we are seeing now. The trouble is there in Europe, but the United States being the kind of mother country of this monopoly capitalistic system, it's still a bit immune from those headwinds. But things are going to be pretty bad soon here also, because the budget deficit is beginning to fall. And the falling budget deficit is what causes these systems to fall, because wages are stagnant.
So what would you... Is this just going to be a situation of the crash is going to happen, people are going to realize the error of their ways, and we'll go on? Is that how you see this? And we'll figure out something, an alternative to this? Is that what you see playing out?
That's right. I see an alternative to the system, and that the new system will be one of economic democracy. See, we need a system where wages automatically rise when productivity does. Because unless that happens, we have to keep increasing our budget deficits and postpone the problem on to the future generations, our children. Right. So it's a horrible system. And plus, just look at this. In the past 3 years, from 2009 to 2012, the budget deficit was $1.5 trillion. And the justification was that we need this to create jobs. Now, we created 1 million jobs in every year over the past 3 years and spent $1.5 trillion to create 1 million jobs. If you divide $1.5 trillion by 1 million, you get 1.5 million. So we spent $1.5 million to create one job, which pays only $50,000 on average. So where is the rest going? It's going all to the rich people, and our budget deficits enriching the rich at a fastest possible pace, and our government keeps wondering, why are the rich getting richer?
You know, Arnold Toynbee, I believe it was, said that when the last man who remembers the horrors of the last Great War dies, the next Great War becomes inevitable. And Steve Keen, an Australian economist on our program last week, suggested that the main thing that constrained banksters up until the 1970s was that most of the people in a position of power in the banking industry remembered the last Great Depression, and that when they started dying off and the boomers who were born after the Great Depression started taking those positions of power and they had no recollection of bankers run amok, then the next crash became inevitable, or the next banking scandal. How does that fit in with your theory of social cycles, and does this all make sense to you?
Oh, yes, it certainly does. In fact, I have been writing about this kind of scenario for the past 30 years.
Right.
And this is all part of the law of social cycle. The law of social cycle is an inevitable law of nature. I have studied history over the past 5,000 years, and I found that in every civilization, there were revolutions. The age of acquisitors ended up in the throes of revolutions. And And toward the end of that age of acquisitors, there was so much wealth concentration and people had to constantly borrow money to survive that in the end they simply overthrew the rule of money in society, and then a new age was born. So now our monopoly capitalism is that age of acquisitors towards its end. In the new system, we would have economic democracy in which majority shares of large corporations will be in the hands of employees themselves. So the CEOs would be answerable to the employees, and then when productivity goes up, automatically wages would rise. When that happens, we don't need any kind of government intervention. We don't need budget deficits at all to keep employment high.
Now, the German Constitution, at the suggestion of Harry Truman, has built into it, and this was, you know, Truman was fighting the Republicans on labor unions really, really hard. I mean, to the point that they overrode his veto on Taft-Hartley, has built into it a statement that any corporation that employs more than 1,000 people has to have half of the seats on its board of directors occupied by representatives of organized labor, of the labor unions that work in that corporation. Is that representation of labor in the German industrial society, is that one of the reasons, in your opinion, why Germany hasn't collapsed the way so many of the other countries around it have? Because their wages have kept up?
It definitely is. It definitely is. And their system comes close to economic democracy, although in a democratic economy, you don't have the need for unions because unions are the majority owners. You won't even need unions in a democratic economic system.
Do you see what's happened in Argentina since 2001, 2002, where so many of the factory owners flood the country and people just went in, reopened the factories, took them over, and now you've got a lot of worker-owned cooperatives in Argentina? Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
That's right. That's exactly what we are talking about. In large corporations, the majority shares will be in the hands of the employees, whereas in smaller companies, there will be co-ops. And in such a system, whenever somebody becomes more productive, automatically their wages would rise. And when that happens, you don't need any government interference. You don't need any budget deficits. You don't need to print a lot of money and risk inflation. You don't have stock market bubbles and crashes or housing bubbles and crashes. You have a great economic system when you have a democratic economy. And by the way, there is evolution of society over time. So through that evolution, we have reached the stage of political democracy. The next stage is one of economic democracy.
How do we, in the process of getting there, how do we make that transition?
Well, I think there is going to be another major stock market crash, and then the stock prices would fall sharply. The government would be able to buy these shares dirt cheap and then sell these shares on installment basis to employees, and that takes care of it.
So the government would have to intervene to do this. How do you restrain a new billionaire class from forming out of this? How do you keep what happened, you know, like the oligarchs who rose up in many of the former Soviet states? How do you prevent? Because, you know, everybody got to own their apartment. Everybody had a share in the company, sort of like what you're describing. And then people went around and bought up those shares from people who didn't realize their value, aggregated them, and now, boom, you've got your back to, you know, hyper-billionaires. How do you prevent that from happening?
Well, through a responsive government. After all, our American oligarchs tried to prevent Obama's election in 2008, didn't they? And then again, they tried their best in 2012. And remember, I was on your show again and again, and I said, Obama is going to be reelected no matter what. And 2009 was the beginning of this revolution. The election of a black candidate as president was unprecedented, and that was the start of this revolution. And it takes about seven and a half years before the revolution succeeds. So that's why I have chosen the year 2016. 2009 plus 7 is 2016. And I think that's the year when monopoly capitalism collapses in the United States.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Dr. Batra, another 4 minutes of your time, if we may.
Sure.
Okay, thank you. We'll be right back. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Dr. Ravi Batra on the line with us. Ravi Batra, RaviBatra.com is his website. His most recent books, Greenspan's Fraud, and, of course, The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos, in which he foresaw all this stuff that's happening right now.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
He explained how it would happen, how it is happening, and what we can do about it. It's a great book. Check it out, The New Golden Age. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 10 minutes before the hour, and thought-provoking conversation with Dr. Ravi Batra, in which he's suggesting that if we raised our minimum wage, then maybe we could avoid economic disaster. But basically, you've got to have one of two things. You've either got to have more money in people's pockets to create demand, and that demand, of course, is what drives the economy. Economies live on demand. Or you've got to have government spending to create demand. Government spending going into the pockets of people. And it's not up on the board yet. There we go. Yeah, so, but let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service and find out what else is going on in the world. Talk Radio News brought to you by Bob Ney's new book, Sideswiped, and Lessons Learned, courtesy of the hitmen of Capitol Hill. And N-E-Y is how Ney is spelled, Bob Ney. And Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I didn't plan that.
You didn't plan? Oh, to be on the day that you're. Yeah, but Talk Radio News. Ellen said, "Okay, we're going to start sponsoring in Bob Ney's book as the sponsor."
So. I didn't plan it.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. It's got nothing to do with you. It's a great coincidence, though.
Yes.
So, and it's a brilliant book. So, what's going on in the world today, Bob?
Well, you got the autopsy. Well, we've got some international things, but I got to get to the autopsy first because. The Republicans are trying to recreate an image, so they use the word autopsy to do it. And this is the report, and it's by the chairman previous and of the Republican National Committee. And more of this, Tom, just on the inside track, is about his personality and is this, you know, is he going to be able to follow through on this? He's setting the marker high.
He being?
Chairman previous.
Okay.
Because he has been considered wishy-washy.
Yeah.
And so now he's set this marker and let's see how he produces on it in the next couple of years.
Well, but he is constrained, is he not, by the Tea Party movement and the billionaires who run and own so much of his party?
Well, that's his problem. In the old days of the Republican Party, in particular Democratic Party be the same, you know, the chairs ruled and the chairs would sometimes create policy. Today, it's a different world. And with the Republican side, you've got the Tea Party. And the people are, you know, all over the place now in the Republican Party. Rob Portman reverses himself on gay marriage today. Rand Paul, who was coming out as the darling statistically out of the CPAC conservative convention, I can guarantee you probably doesn't have the same statistics today for daring to bring up the word immigration. And he doesn't call for amnesty, but surely calls for looking, quote, at a path. And I think that in itself is probably an example of how the party is in a real, you know,
disarray.
Flux position of where it's going to go.
Now, did you say Rob Portman reversed himself? Is this reversing his reversal?
No. I'm just saying in his reversal of being against gay marriage and coming out.
So you're talking about what happened last week.
For gay marriage. But on the heels of the Portman announcement comes Rand Paul, then this autopsy report and the question of the Republicans morphing into what positions they want to be. But they'll still have the, you know, the advocacy groups, the top donors screaming in a different direction.
Yeah. They just need to rename themselves the Whigs and get it over with.
This is a tough one, especially with the, you know, the head of the Republican National Committee, and this is kind of personally about him. On a policy note, my home state of Ohio, Sherrod Brown, our senator, was the only no vote today, and he is not going to hold up the appointment of Mary Jo White. Was her appointment to lead the Securities and Exchange Commission, but he voiced his dismay at having a kind of, quote, Wall Street person taking the helm of this position. He was the only no vote.
So Sherrod Brown is concerned that the fox is now guarding the chicken coop. It was like 99-1 kind of vote?
This was the committee, so it was a 21-1 vote.
I see.
To approve her nomination.
Wow.
The point he's making, he said, look, he's dismayed that they don't go outside Wall Street
right.
to, you know, surely there's somebody, is what Sherrod is saying, Senator Brown is saying, that has the cerebral know-how to judge these issues and doesn't have to have worked on Wall Street.
Yeah.
He makes a, probably a very good point.
Yeah, although you'd have to look at the individuals. I mean, there may be some high-integrity people who happen to have worked. I think Elizabeth Warren spent some time on Wall Street, did she not?
Yes, yes, she
and
did.
So,
and the president is headed to the Middle East. The issue of Jonathan Pollard, the convicted spy who's been in prison for 28 years, will be raised again, but that kind of happens when presidents visit to Israel. Most of the conversation is going to be around Syria. What are we going to do if they actually are transporting missiles into Lebanon to Hezbollah? And also the ever-ongoing Iran issue. So it's just a pretty big trip for the president because, you know, there's been some problems with he and Netanyahu.
Right. Is it confirmed now that the Syrian rebels are using poison gas? And if so, what's the blowback from that?
Well, they're saying that, you know, the Syrian government, of course, is saying that the rebels did it, and the rebels are saying that the Syrian government did it. Somebody did it. And means there are some weapons somewhere. Now, does it go to the rank of weapons of mass destruction where we invaded a country based on something that wasn't accurate? I mention that because today's the 10th anniversary of it.
Yes.
And you're not going to find anybody celebrating the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War like we used to when we were in Congress.
Yeah. Other than maybe Dick Cheney. Yeah.
Maybe Dick Cheney. Yes, he'll have his own private birthday celebration on it.
Yeah.
Of course, he's dismayed because we didn't just go into Iran and level it at the same time.
That's freaky. So what else is going on in the world?
Well, those are the main issues today, except, of course, for the forestalling of the closure of the government on kind of a bipartisan basis. The Senate is moving. That's one thing on a March 27th deadline, so it'll extend it to October 1st. The big one, I think, in D.C., the biggest story of the day is, you know, the Harry Reid did not go along with Senator Feinstein's assault weapons ban. It was removed.
Yeah.
Before the bill went into its motions, I imagine she will bring it up as a separate vote. But that one in itself has raised some
tackles. I'm curious your take also on why over the weekend you had two different Republicans come out and say we don't have a short-term debt crisis when they've been running around with their hair on fire for 4 years.
I have no idea. I have no idea why on earth they would come out and say that.
Do you think it's possible if they've cut a deal with the president in the back room and this is the first step of getting their own base ready for it?
Maybe they think they have, but I don't know. I don't know how they don't think that there is a debt crisis. We've had a debt crisis, you know, for years.
Yeah, or at least we've been told that we have a debt crisis.
Oh, yeah. Now, the fiscal cliff was overblown.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, very interesting. Bob Ney.
Thank you.
The Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. And check out his new book, Sideswiped. Bob, thanks a lot for being with us. We will be back with Tim Carpenter. What is the state of democracy in the Democratic Party? Right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, we've covered war. We've covered economics. What's left? Politics! Tim Carpenter is in the studio with us. He's the National Director of Progressive Democrats of America, a group that is not affiliated with the Democratic Party, but they sure do push them hard and ride them hard. Tim, great to have you back with us.
Tom, thanks so much. Thanks for the opportunity again.
And the website, of course, pdamerica.org.
But don't go there for another 6 minutes.
Why is that?
Because we got to talk before they run off to the booth.
Okay. So you guys had a big event today in Capitol Hill.
Well, last month, as you know, we were out here with our Progressive Roundtable. Today, 4 months in a row, PDA was in the Cannon Office Building meeting with our Progressive Caucus members, Alan Grayson, among others. As most of the listeners probably know, hopefully by now, tomorrow we get to play offense. The Progressive Caucus has its budget, so today, banging on doors, phones are ringing. Those of you on the West Coast, keep dialing. I can let you know every office I went, they were jamming up those phone lines.
Okay, I thought the vote was today. It's going to be tomorrow?
Tomorrow. Officially been moved till tomorrow, so we've got everybody on the West Coast, keep going.
Just so everybody understands, the Progressive Caucus has presented a budget. It's called the Back to Work budget.
Correct.
And this budget is actually a progressive budget, and it'll actually solve many of the problems of America, and it raises wages, and this is just a great budget. And John Boehner is actually going to allow a vote on this thing, and that vote will be tomorrow. So call your – you can go to callcongress.org. Do you have phone numbers over at pdamerica.org as well?
No, we don't. We're okay. Virtual. But pdamerica.org okay. for updates. The important stuff on this particular Call Your Member of Congress, as we spoke last month, Tom, is to get off of this whole discussion of austerity. We need to talk about prosperity. This budget yes. creates jobs, does do the deficit reduction, but doesn't cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Most importantly for us, the talk we've been having is to talk on the revenue side. Finally, we get the Robin Hood tax and the carbon tax, so we get a vote tomorrow on these fundamental issues we've been struggling to get before Congress.
And this is a real, what's the old song, what side are you on?
Members have to line up and vote. We, PDA, since Monday, is that just yesterday, have been in district offices by the 8th. Vote tomorrow night. We will visit at 100. Mike Fox, our guy on the phones right now, we're jamming the phone lines. Credo's working. So district offices as well as D.C., this is an opportunity to have your voice heard. This is small-D democracy in the real sense. We get a vote on those issues that are important to us. And as you said, it's time to divide the House and see which side they're on.
Yeah. So call your member of Congress, especially if they're a Democrat, but even if they're a Republican.
No,
Parliament, you know, the Republicans could vote for this as some sort of nefarious scheme to blow up the actual Democrat, because there's another Democratic budget. And they might
that's
actually...
the Senate Democrats, right.
Right. They might actually help out.
Well, it's an interesting time over on the aisle because you find people like Congressmember Walter Jones, who's working today on the 10-year anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, who's talking very much about getting those troops home right. rapidly and quickly. So there's a lot of Democrat-Republican coming together on these issues, and it's an interesting time. And as you said, most importantly is to really pick up the line, make a difference. If you can get out to your district offices tomorrow, the vote should be in the evening. There'll be 8 progressive members of the Progressive Caucus, led by Keith Ellison and Raul Grijalva, who'll take to the well. Watch it on C-SPAN. This is the real thing. Capra and Mr. Smith goes to Washington. Moment for folks to get in front of their TVs tomorrow and keep ringing those phone lines.
Right. We've had Keith Ellison and Raul Grijalva on both of them on this program in the last week talking about the progressive budget. And this is a BFD. This is the real thing. This is an actual solid budget. Paul Ryan's budget says, well, we're going to cut, but we're not going to tell you what we're going to cut. And we're going to raise revenue.
Empty holes in that budget if you look closely.
Oh, it's incredible. It's incredible. I mean, there's all these, you know, asterisks that lead to footnotes that say to be decided later. This is not the case with the progressive budget, with the back-to-work budget.
No, it's laid out very systematically. Again, if you go to the Progressive Caucus, the CPC, it's all out there. There's an 18-page executive summary. You can take a look at it.
Do you have a link to that off pdamerica.org?
Yes. If you come to pdamerica.org, it's all over our website. There's a link called Educate Congress. We're not lobbying. We're educating. All those materials are there. The most important thing is to let your member of Congress know you're watching this time. No longer do we need to talk about cutting Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare. We have a plan to move us from this whole, as we said, debate of austerity to prosperity. These are programs as progressive Democrats we need to be proud of and speak out for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So tomorrow, ring those offices. The Robin Hood tax, as we talked on here, it's time to tax Wall Street and the carbon tax to go after the polluters so we have the real revenue stream. Anywhere, if you look at the Robin Hood tax, from $300 to $350 billion, a carbon tax, they're talking about another $100 billion. There's the monies that we need to really build. This plan specifically talks about 7 million new jobs, specifically talks about putting us back to work, talks about infrastructure building in real terms. None of the Paul Ryan magical numbers and cutting on Social Security and Medicare.
Right. Now, this is a real budget. So now is the time to call your member of Congress. And you can go to callcongress.org. There's some 800 numbers, and then there's the main switchboard number. And if you're not even sure who your member of Congress is, no problem. Call the congressional switchboard and just say, here's my zip code, and they will tell you who your member of Congress is, and they will connect you with them. So it's a very simple, very straightforward process. Check out PD America, Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org, also for information on the progressive budget. And so we're talking with Tim Carpenter, the national director of the Progressive Democrats of America. Tim, what's next?
For us, Progressive Democrats of America, we're electing a new senator out in Massachusetts. We have a primary in April, April 30th. We're working real hard for Ed Markey, who's been out front talking about shutting down the tar sands and XL pipeline, been very out front on this whole question of getting our troops home. So for PDA, Progressive Democrats, we have an election. You don't have
this
to live
for
in
John
Massachusetts.
Kerry's seat.
This is the seat that our new Secretary of State has vacated. Again, you don't have to live in Massachusetts. Get on the phones. Again, we have Mike Fox who will organize you. You can call from your home. You can call those voters in your area. For PDA, we're going to be on the ground to make sure that we get Ed Markey. Can you imagine a Senate with Ed Markey and Elizabeth Warren?
He's a good guy. He's a very progressive Democrat.
I met him initially when I was a young anti-nuclear activist in the early 80s when we came to Washington, similar as we do today, knocking on doors. And he took his subcommittee at that time in 1982 on nuclear oversight. So we've watched Ed Markey for some time. So to put him in the Senate is very exciting. So I encourage folks, if they haven't already, visit Ed Markey for Senate. I know we're not supposed to talk about races, but at the PDA website, be a part of that. That'll be a very important race coming up. And then we'll be back in D.C., on the 19th, National Lobby Day for the Robin Hood tax. Keith Ellison will roll it out again. He was with you at Progressive Central where we talked about it during the inaugural. So we're back here on the 19th and the 20th. So we're keeping busy at PDA.
Over the weekend, we had a couple of – you had John Boehner and I believe it was Rens Priebus. It was another one of the Republicans on one of the Sunday shows saying, we don't have an immediate budget crisis or deficit crisis or whatever, and which is completely opposite of what they've been saying for the last 4 years. My conspiracy theory is that the president has said to, you know, he's been lobbying individual members and that he, Republicans, and that he might have gotten enough of them to go along with some Democrats to say, okay, we'll put the change CPI, we will cut, I will be the first president to cut Social Security. If you guys will, you don't have to actually raise marginal tax rates. You can say that you've bowed down to Lord Grover, but let's close some of the loopholes. Let's, you know, do away with the old depletion allowance or things like that. And he's going to have some sort of a grand bargain that he thinks is going to be like the way Lincoln negotiated the 13th Amendment. Are you guys, do you see something like that coming down the road? And if so, what do we do? We have a minute.
Definitely, certainly concerned. And less than a minute is the letter that Alan Grayson is pushing through to make sure there is a line in the sand, unlike single payer, that the Progressive Caucus holds. Currently, there's only 32 members in the Progressive Caucus who said they'll hold that line. So we got to make sure we shore up ourselves. And yes, that's our biggest fear, that the deal's been cut. We've watched this president now for 5 years. So take to the streets, get a hold of your member of Congress and let him know we're going to keep an eye on that. And no giving in at all on anything in regards to Social Security. There's no problem there, something that we need to be proud of. And yes, we're definitely concerned, and we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, no change CPI. And you can call the White House on that.
Absolutely. And the decision's coming down now on tar sands, the XL pipeline. Call the president. Tell him to hold the line there. We're going to have a decision. That'll be the first big decision for Secretary of State Kerry, which way we're going to go there. And we were meeting about that today. People are taking their pledges, whether it be risking arrest or whatever, to continue to raise the stakes. Hold the president accountable on that question as well.
There you go. I mean, the president's not going to behave like a progressive unless progressives push him to behave like a progressive. So
join PDA and push.
There you go. PDAmerica.org. Show up. Participate. This is your tag, you're it moment. PDAmerica.org. Tim Carpenter, thanks so much for being with us, Tim.
Thank you.
Great having you with us. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
PDAmerica.org. Get there. Sign up. Participate. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Cyprus has said no to the banksters. We're not going to rob Peter to pay Paul. We're not going to rob average people's savings accounts and checking accounts to pay for the banksters crashing the economy, basically. And the banksters are upset about this. They're not liking this at all. So we, you know, what's the old Chinese curse? May you live in interesting times. Here we are. Peggy in Bend, Oregon. Hey, Peggy, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey,
Hi,
Peggy.
Higgins.
Higgins is, he's getting, you know, he's like 14, 15 years old. So he's slowed down a little, although he did scratch my hand up pretty badly. You can't see it on the camera, but earlier in the week he attacked me, so, which he rarely does anymore. But so he's still got a little frisky in him.
I'm not going to ask what you did to him.
I tried to rub his stomach.
Ah.
He does not, you know, he does not like that. You can pet his back, but if you try and rub his stomach, he will just. So anyway, crazy cat.
Anyway. I'm calling about the 10th anniversary of our glorious, there he is, about our glorious invasion of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And the possibility was raised of charging Bush, Cheney, and that whole command with war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of couple of impediments there. The first is that the U.S. doesn't recognize the Hague, you know, the ICC.
Right. We didn't sign the, what was the name of the, say that again? The Rome Convention, Shano says it
was. The ICC?
Yeah.
International Criminal Court.
Right.
Yeah.
That created that.
They don't recognize that. The second impediment is that the Obama administration is sweeping those crimes, those atrocities, under the rug. Remember they said,
mm-hmm.
we're looking forward, not back.
Right.
We're not going to prosecute anything.
Right. And every criminal in America thought, oh, cool. You know, and then they all realized, oh, wait a minute, he's just talking about the Bush administration.
He's talking about Bush, right. And instead of prosecuting Bush, Cheney et al., they're prosecuting the whistleblowers.
Yes, this administration has prosecuted more whistleblowers than all previous administrations combined.
That's right. And two of those are worth mentioning. One is, of course, Bradley Manning, and the second is John Kiriakou.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bradley Manning deserves, I think, the Nobel Peace Prize for just releasing to WikiLeaks that little piece of video called Collateral Murder.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that?
Yep.
The Apache pilots, how were they described? Gleefully assassinating the Reuters cameraman.
That's right.
And some other civilians. And then when the father driving his two children to school pulled up to try to rescue some of the wounded, the Apache pilots turned their fire and murdered him and severely wounded the two children. Of course, those two Apache pilots, as far as I know, have never been named, and they've never been prosecuted, and they never will be.
Right.
But
although I would suggest to you, Peggy, that they are probably collateral damage as well, that those guys would have to be genuine sociopaths not to be feeling horrible, to be haunted by this. And this is, again, so many of our soldiers who were sent over to Iraq and Afghanistan and committed horrible acts in the name of the Bush administration, in some cases believing they were doing the right thing, in other cases just doing what they were told. So many of them are coming back now. We've got a suicide a day. You know, these people are committing suicide like crazy. The post-traumatic stress disorders are off the roof. Are off the scale. We've never seen anything like this before. And I think it's because they're realizing the horror of what they did and the worthlessness of what they did. It's a genuine tragedy.
Genuine tragedy. And I'm still kind of choked up from that letter from Tomas that you read earlier today.
From Tomas Young. And this is why, and yeah, maybe we can't take Bush to The Hague. Spain actually has laws on the books that would allow a Spanish judge, Spanish prosecutor, to prosecute Bush and Cheney. And the Center for Constitutional Rights, Michael Ratner, Ellen Ratner's brother, Michael Ratner runs that. And they nearly got it done. And then the Spanish kind of backed off, basically, I think, because our administration said time to back off. So we need to be pushing this administration to say, particularly on this 10th anniversary, but, you know, period, as we go forward. And in my mind, it's not just Iraq, it's Afghanistan as well. That was also an unnecessary war. You know, if we wanted to get bin Laden, the Taliban offered to hand him over to George W. Bush, and George W. Bush said, no, I'd rather bomb your country. And I don't think most Americans realize that. They didn't read that, you know, they weren't paying attention the morning that story was in the Washington Post. So, but Peggy, I got to move along. Thank you for the call, and thanks for your comments and sharing with us. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul. Got a minute to the break. What's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom. First, thanks for telling us the truth about the Iraq war, because, you know, we certainly can't get it from the corporate billionaire media.
It seems.
I also wanted – I'm an economist, and I wanted to agree with everything that, you know, Dr. Robbie was saying. But I wanted to add one thing I don't think you mentioned. Another good way to help fix the economy, you know, for real – is to raise taxes on multimillionaires and billionaires. Mm-hmm. And the effect of that is to take money out of their Swiss bank accounts and circulate in our economy.
Right.
And also, I also want to point out that, you know who benefits the most from raising taxes on multimillionaires and billionaires? Multimillionaires and billionaires do. But it's just a delayed reaction. You know, they'd rather have a dollar in their hand today than $2 in their hand 6 months from now. They're short-sighted.
Remarkable. And I agree with you, Paul. And in fact, Larry Beinhart has done some really great research on how whenever the tax rate's above 50% on millionaires and billionaires, you don't have all this hot money flowing into the economy, and therefore you don't have all this risky behavior. Paul, Shano tells me that you've won our book, Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country, by me, an autographed copy. So I'm going to put you on hold here. Paul in South Lyon is on line 6, tell Danielle. And we'll get that off to you, courtesy of Stamps.com. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I see a crash coming. I think 2015. Ravi Batra says 2016. Your thoughts? The good, the bad, and the very, very macrosummatously ugly, the good. U.S. District Judge Audrey Flessig, the presiding judge for the Eastern District of Missouri, won an important victory for Obamacare and women's health Monday when she struck down a state law that would allow religious organizations to refuse to provide birth control coverage through their employee health plans. The battle between supporters and opponents of the 2010 health care law's mandate on birth control coverage for people participating in employee health plans has been one of the fiercest political fights of the past year. And that's one of the longest run-on sentences. Although the law states that religious employers like Catholic schools don't have to actually pay for birth control, the insurance company handles that, conservative religious organizations claim the mandate violates their First Amendment rights. Technicalities aside, Judge Flessig's decision ensures that all Missouri women will have access to affordable birth control regardless of where they work. Don't forget that the GOP's war on women is still very much alive. We need heroes like Judge Flessig to hit back against the conservative onslaught. The bad. Cable news networks. CNN disgraced itself already this week with its sympathetic coverage of the Steubenville rapists. But it dug itself into a deeper hole Monday when it aired an unedited tape of defendant Malik Richmond's post-trial speech in which the convicted rapist addressed his victim by name. Fox News, MSNBC, and CBS have also played unredacted clips of the speech. This is simply wrong. The Steubenville rape victim endured enough shame for a lifetime when her attackers posted mocking photos of the incident on Facebook and Twitter. Unedited national broadcasts of Richmond's speech exacerbate that shame. There are certain situations in which media outlets have an obligation not to tell us everything, and this was one of them. CNN, Fox, MSNBC, you didn't do your job. And the very, very ugly NRA organizer Colton Kerrigan. At a CPAC NRA seminar over the weekend, NRA organizer Colton Kerrigan tried to demonstrate the idiocy of pro-gun control Democrats by playing a clip of New York Representative Carolyn McCarthy faltering when asked about the function of a barrel shroud.
So these lawmakers, when they speak laws, have no idea what they're talking about. They've never shot a firearm before. They couldn't tell you what a barrel shroud is. They couldn't tell you what a mount is for a bayonet. They probably couldn't even tell you what a flash suppressor is. But yet, these are the people who are writing the laws and say we need to ban these certain types of firearms. Actually, Dianne Feinstein has said if she could get all 51 votes, she would have had Mr. and Mrs. America turn in all their guns. But she couldn't do it, and that's why she went with the original 1994 ban.
Congressman McCarthy may not know the technical function of a barrel shroud, but she certainly knows a thing or two about the dangers of easy access to high-capacity weapons. In 1993, an armed madman killed her husband, Dennis, on a Long Island Railroad train. As Scott Keyes from Think Progress points out, to say that a woman who personally knows the tragic impact firearms have but has never shot a gun before can't have a valid perspective on gun laws is ludicrous. That the NRA and its representatives can so easily dismiss personal experience with violence as unimportant to the gun control debate is very, very ugly. mind-bogglingly ugly. Randy, in Kaukauna, Wisconsin. How do you say that, Randy? Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Oh, that'd be Kaukauna.
Okay. So, Randy, what's on your mind? You want to talk about the Iraq War?
Yeah, well, this week being the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War, it seems in true American ingrown self-indulgent fashion, we tend to only think of ourselves and our own involvement in that bogus war. But how about the nations in the coalition that were badgered into the war? Great Britain, Australia, Poland, and others. I mean, what are they thinking? And what are they saying about being lied into that war, especially in light of the hubris documentary out now? And, you know, in what stead does that put us with these and other countries?
Yeah, this is a time for us to, at the very least, apologize to these other nations as well. And, you know, again, this is why I think that an international prosecution of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney for war crimes is called for, even if there's not a legal venue for it right at the moment, because the UN hasn't signed on to the conventions that brought this about. We have war criminals in our midst. We need to call it out. We need to say it out loud. We need to acknowledge it. And frankly, I think we need to do something about it. Randy, thank you for the call. Marty and the other nations involved. It'd be interesting to hear what they have to say. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. Hey, Marty, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Well, you were asking that the stock market is going to go kaput. And what I've noticed, I've did a little bit of research on the correlation between the national debt and the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and you can kind of see them both creep up in tandem, pretty much in parallel. So what I predict is that as soon as we start paying down the national debt, aka eliminating the savings of a lot of the working class people, that you're going to see the Dow Jones crash right along with that. And at that point, you're going to see a lot of the billionaires that hold, the majority of the stocks just sell them off at the highest point, and then they're going to intentionally crash the stock market, leaving, all of the investors with worthless stock.
I agree.
So I think that it'll have, as soon as we start paying down that national debt, that we're going to see, the Dow Jones just pretty much completely collapse, and
right.
All the rich billionaires are going to basically get out when the getting's good.
I agree with you, Marty, and I'm guessing that we're going to see that happen in the next year or two. We'll see how long it takes, but this is certainly something the Republicans are pushing for. And as Ravi Batra explained, there's a very, very easy understanding, a really easy explanation for that mechanism, and that is that up until the Reagan presidency, productivity increased, wages increased, so the national debt just didn't matter that much one way or the other. It was always fairly low. But then when Reagan decoupled wages from productivity by smashing unions and just basically going after that connection and changing the rules by which companies operated and offshoring, changing our trade policies, when that decoupling happened, in order to maintain demand in the economy, which is what keeps an economy going, government spending had to go up. And Reagan tripled the national debt. George Herbert Walker Bush added another trillion or so to it. Bill Clinton added another trillion or so to it. Clinton balanced the budget in 1999. Why'd you have a stock market crash in 2000? And, on it goes. I mean, it's just, I think you're absolutely right. And, we shall see. But the other thing that I've noticed is on TV lately, I'm seeing a lot of ads for brokerage firms. You can buy exchange traded funds from us, and you can buy, and we exceed the Lipper average or whatever the phrases are. And it reminds me of back in 2006 and 2007, all the ads I was seeing on TV for, here, interest rates are only 4.5%, you can refinance, or 3.9%, you can refinance your home, and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like when they start hyping something on TV, that's the time to run. It's the old Joe Kennedy, when the shoeshine boy and the taxi driver start giving me stock market advice, I know it's time to get out of the market. Because that, when it hits mass culture, when it hits mass advertising, that's the point at which the billionaires are basically, that's the extraction from the middle class. That's get the middle class all in this poker game so that we can fold our hand and walk away from the table with all the chips. And not a good sign. Marty, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening to WCPT. Frank in Portland, Maine. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I love your show.
Thank you.
I'm a Native American, American Indian, whose bloodline goes back to Tecumseh and before that. And one of the things that was penned recently by a gentleman who passed away last year was misinformation is indeed a weapon of mass destruction. And as an American Indian, I certainly can attest to the effect that that has had on my culture. And you know, the things that really bothered me is the onus really is on individuals in this country to take it upon themselves to become educated about what our leaders are doing and hold them accountable at all costs. Mm-hmm. And the scary part about it is that if you remember after the war had started, patriotism was, you know, rampant in this country where everybody was waving an American flag. And if you said anything contrary to the war and what Bush was doing, you were seen as an enemy and unpatriotic.
Right.
And I was at breakfast with one of my coworkers who was a right-wing Christian, if you will, and I told him outright that the George Bush lied to us and got us into the war under nefarious circumstances. And the gentleman was so adamant about that he didn't lie that he was ready to go to fisticuffs with it over me. And this is just something that to me is just abhorrent that, you know, this is nothing that America needs to be proud of. We need to change this. And Americans at a grassroots level can do that. I believe that.
I think that the big indicator for me, Frank, is that this is the 10th anniversary of a war, and we're not having any celebrations. There's very little discussion about it in any kind of positive context. The 10th, you know, 10 years after World War II ended, you know, I was a little kid, but maybe that was the year I was born. No, I was probably 2, 3, 4 years old. But I'm guessing that the media was doing memorials and, you know, let's remember the men who died and let's, you know, isn't it a good thing that Hitler's gone and Tojo's been defeated and all that kind of thing. We're not doing that right now. That speaks to me that we're a nation in shame. This is not the only one. The Holocaust against your people, the Native Americans, the Holocaust against African Americans in this country, the wiping out of you know, so much of the Iraqi culture. There's so much that we need to answer for. Frank, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. Our show, by the way, in part brought to you, well, not even brought to you, just check out Don Siegelman, free-don.org. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Sam in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Hey, Sam, thanks for listening to SiriusXM.
Hello.
Hey.
I'd like to defend what we did in Iraq. I think that Bush's national security advisors were telling him that it was the move to make, and that the policy that Clinton had followed, namely, which is assassination of Al-Qaeda figures, had failed. And that Bush's national security team said, if we get closer to Iran and the Shiites, that would be a positive.
Okay, let me just unpack this, Sam. Let me try to understand what you're saying. First of all, Al-Qaeda was a Sunni group. It's not right. A Shia group.
No, Al-Qaeda was bin Laden,
who was
protesting Egyptian-style police states.
Right. Who was a Sunni
for the terror?
And Al-Qaeda did not have anybody in Iraq because
I understand
Saddam Hussein saw Al-Qaeda as competition.
Bin Laden. He was protesting Sunni police states like Saddam.
No. Go back and read your history. Osama bin Laden was not protesting Sunni police states. He was protesting secular Sunni states. His objection to Saddam and the reason he went back to Saudi Arabia to try and launch an invasion of Iraq, and he actually raised an army in Saudi Arabia, and they got up to the border when the Saudis stopped them, arrested him, and deported him out of the country, stripped him of his passport. That's when he said, okay, if I can't go after Saddam, I'm going to go after America. The reason that he was going after Saddam in Iraq was because Saddam Hussein was running a secular state. He was allowing women to attend college. He was allowing women to drive cars. He was allowing people to sell and buy and drink alcohol in public. He was allowing.
And he was also protesting Egyptian-style terror states and torture.
No, he was not.
Buy that?
I don't buy that, Sam. I've actually read the collected writings of Osama bin Laden. There's this book called The Collected Writings of Osama bin Laden, and it goes back like 15, 20 years. I've read everything he's written. I wrote a book review of it for BuzzFlash back 3 years ago.
You want to make fine distinctions about what he's...
There's no fine distinction here whatsoever. Osama bin Laden was all about religion.
Okay, but Bush's...
He was a religious fanatic.
The advisors told him that a good move would be to get closer, to make... Iraq more closer to the Shiites, to their Shiite population.
No,
very good.
This is not what the people who were in the CIA at the time are telling us. They're telling us instead that Dick Cheney was going down there saying, "You better give me what I want."
No, his national security team told Bush that. The neocons told him that.
So you're blaming this on what? Wolfowitz, Feith, and
I'm saying our president had advice to do it.
How do you respond how do you respond to George W. Bush in 1999 telling his biographer that if he became president he was going to invade Iraq? How do you respond to
But you know, he was our president.
His cabinet
had failed.
His very first
he made his move.
No, his very
our president made his move, which is namely...
Wait a minute, you're saying he made his move against Al-Qaeda by going into Iraq?
What? Yes, on a geopolitical, on a chess games scale, that was the move to make. We couldn't directly go after...
That's nonsense. That's complete nonsense, Sam. I mean, you know, respectfully, it's nonsense. You had Saddam Hussein, who hated Osama bin Laden. If he had gotten near him, he would have arrested him or executed him. Tried to work with Saddam Hussein, he might have helped us get Osama bin Laden, although the Taliban already had Osama bin Laden and offered to give him to George Bush the week after 9/11. And George Bush said, no, I don't want him. I want to start bombing your country.
You're saying that bin Laden wasn't protesting Saddam. I don't want to blame the victim. I mean, you know, we're not accepting what bin Laden says, but I could see... legitimately our president getting his national security advice and following through on it. And, you know, since then there's been...
Why was his first cabinet meeting? This was before there was any national security advice at all. This was 4 or 5 days into his administration. His first cabinet meeting, the guy who is his Secretary of Commerce, who wrote a book about this...
Wolfowitz and those guys...
After the fact, said in the first cabinet meeting, Wolfowitz was not in the room,
carrying it out.
In the first cabinet meeting, George Bush, out of nowhere, raised the issue of how are we going to get into Iraq and finish what my dad started.
Objectively, though, our policy
and
had
nothing,
failed.
This was 7 months before 9/11.
No, objectively, Clinton's technique of assassination had failed, right? Because 9/11 happened.
Clinton was
His strategy failed.
Actually, Clinton's strategy was working out fairly well. The problem that he had, he threw those three cruise missiles into Afghanistan to try to assassinate bin Laden, you're right, and missed him by a half hour. And if you'll recall, when that happened in 1999 or 2000, whichever year it was, the Republicans, and particularly the right-wing talk radio show hosts, were all running around saying that Bill Clinton was sending these missiles after Osama bin Laden, not for any legitimate national security purpose, but because he wanted the nation to forget about Monica Lewinsky. He was being impeached. And Clinton was saying, no, this guy's a threat to us. I'm trying to take him out. And the Republicans were yelling and screaming, going, oh, this is a distraction from his impeachment. And we really need to, you know, the big crisis that we really need to worry about, the Republicans were saying, is whether or not the president was having sex under the table with his intern. You remember that?
I think we're far afield from, you know.
No, Sam, you're saying Clinton's policies failed. Clinton's policies, they were, you had the FBI tracking one of the, you had the FBI tracking the 9/11 guys. It's just that, you know, they weren't, the information didn't get to the CIA or vice versa. But this, Bush, this is a total intelligence failure by the Bush administration. For 9 months he was president, for 9 months we had the information that 9/11 was coming. George Bush was personally warned by the Germans, by the Israelis, and by the Russians that this was coming, and he did nothing about it. In fact, he took the longest vacation in presidential history. Anyhow, tomorrow, we'll have more tomorrow. It's time to wrap the show up. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag your it. Go to pdamerica.org.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.